tell me when your own interest in the supernatural really kicked off, and do you remember what it was that?
I think I actually always have been. So I think it's been it's BBC Two double bills on Saturday nights, where they would show you two Hammer House films, and I was 11 and 12 and was totally terrified, I think. And that's quite a common story of people who get into Gothic, is that there's a sense of seeing something you're not supposed to see, and seeing X films when you're 11 or 12, and you're just totally kind of, you're arrested adolescent, basically, that's it.
And when did the sort of literary side of it begin to attract you?
Literary side has always been, because I think there is quite a close association between film and the fiction as well. So they're both, you have B-movies on the one hand, and you have this kind of low cultural, ghastly, gothic stuff that you're not supposed to read in literature classes and so on. So there's that kind of sense of transgression for both of them. So I think I've always read them alongside each other, and they feed off each other. And, you know, with Bram Stoker, you see multiple adaptations, and it's always interesting to see how they go back to the novel and rework it and try and rethink it in various ways. So I think they go together. So once you start on one form, film, you end up reading the fiction, and vice versa. I think,
if you pardon the terrible pun, I mean, one can't come to this novel in a virginal state, can one? Because there's so much about vampires, there's so much in the culture, particularly in the last decade, that we're coming to it sort of backwards through a great deal of later adaptations or inspirations or similar works in the field.
Yeah, that's the thing about Dracula, is that you say to nearly everyone, I've given people copies of this edition, they say, I don't think I've read this, but they're not entirely sure, because they've seen so many, they know so much about it, and actually nearly always they haven't read it, because they don't know the form of it, and nevertheless they know the story, and they know all the details. So it is a myth, it's a modern myth in a very unusual way. But then Bram Stoker's in the same situation. He is also someone who is not inventing a myth, he's relying on a whole century of stories and narratives about vampires. So actually he invents very little.
Yeah, you meticulously catalogue the vampiric antecedents to this book, and there are a hell of a lot of them, aren't there?
You know, there's a recent anthology of 19th century vampire books that's come out before Dracula, and actually that's over 1,000 pages. It's extraordinary. So I mean, the modern vampire is from these kind of weird documentary reports from the 1730s, which are strange events going on in usually Central Europe, and, you know, precisely around where Bram Stoker situates Dracula in the Balkans and so on. So these sort of strange reports that get half believed, I think, in the so-called advanced West, half disbelieved, and nevertheless they love circulating these stories about graves that are open, people are still alive in them, and then the superstitious Catholic idiotic peasants want to stake this to the ground. And of course, you know, this is great stuff to prove how advanced and civilized we are. So there's lots of that going on. But then the literary myth really starts with Lord Byron's doctor, William Polidori, who wrote this fantastic story, actually, about, you know, the evil Lord Ruthven, who is scandalizing Europe by sleeping with all their daughters, but actually is this kind of vampiric figure as well. So that starts off the modern sense of the vampire as this, not the sort of shuffling, idiotic zombie that you get in superstitions and peasant belief, but actually the really kind of louche, aristocratic, masterful kind of single lone vampire who's after our women.
And vampire's metaphor seems to be written into the story really from pretty early on too, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So the 1730s stories, they nearly always say, well, obviously this isn't about dead people in graves who are still living. It must be some kind of political allegory about the fact that the Balkans are under imperial cosh of the Turks or the Habsburg Empire and so on. So it's clearly a political allegory. And I think that becomes very clear, that it's a very, very mobile metaphor for all kinds of different things, not just political power, not just sexual power, although that I think is why it's so successful in our culture, is that it's a very kind of obvious metaphor of transmission and contagion and corruption and giving yourself up to an alluring pleasure which is nevertheless murderous. Very important for the Victorians, since sex could kill them as it could kill us in present day. So there is this very kind of mobile metaphor about race too as well, so very much about whether this is a kind of an invasion of a foreign state, whether it's a lone Jew, or if it's a metaphor of incomers from the pogroms in Russia and so on. So yeah, it's a very, very mobile metaphor, one that means that that vampire will, I think, probably always be with us, because you can always spin it in another way and it'll always adjust and alter in different kinds of ways.
One fact in your introduction, which I wrote down because it was so bizarre and really emphasized the fact that the past is a foreign country, you maybe can anticipate what I'm going to say, was that anemic women into the 1890s would go along to abattoirs in order to drink the warm blood of slaughtered animals. And that made me think, wow, you know, this is, we, you know, it's quite a long time ago and they did things very differently.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think, you know, the Victorians are really very odd people, actually, very, very, very odd. And I think I think modern readers have to grasp that the 19th century thought about blood, particularly, in a totally different way from we do. They didn't even have, as we know from Van Helsing, didn't even have blood groups yet, because if you did that to Lucy nowadays, she would probably die off from the wrong blood group. So they didn't actually even have blood groups yet. Blood is all about race and all about identity. So therefore, it's this kind of very different power than it has now, but much more medical for us, a machinery of the body, really. This is all about identity. You can still hear it in that kind of sense of they're not our blood and so on, but it's a very, very kind of different sense of it. And so they have very different medical ideas about blood too. So that idea of you must, if you're weak, the best thing to do is imbibe blood was a very common idea. The best way of treating mentally ill patients, as we see with Renfield, is very different ideas from ours now, although it's not in the book. You know, a common treatment in Victorian times would be to kind of stimulate the blood and also to weigh people down with at least 5 pounds of potatoes a day.
Now you mentioned identity there, which is perhaps a good point to bring up the identity of the author, Bram Stoker.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about his background.
Yeah, Bram Stoker is a very interesting figure to talk about, because we know really an incredible amount about him, but we can't really interpret it. There's a kind of public figure, and you always suspect that there's a different kind of private figure that we can't quite get to. So he was born in Ireland in 1847. It's very, very important that he is of a Protestant elite in Dublin, and this is a Catholic country. And there's a minor, very, very small elite minority that are basically ruling a colonial state. All around them in the 1840s, millions of Catholics are dying of starvation or are emigrating to America. So here's someone who's of an elite, a colonial elite. Now, his father is not particularly high up that elite, but he is nevertheless a kind of professional civil servant. And they moved amongst a very elite company. So Bram Stoker knew, for example, Sir William Wilde, who was Oscar Wilde's father. He worked for one famous Irish Gothic writer called Sheridan Le Fanu, who ran a newspaper as well. So he worked for him. And he moved in this circle, and he was brought up to be yet another servant of the state. So he became a civil servant, and actually was a civil servant after leaving university for about 10 years, until he met this extraordinary, charismatic, famous Shakespearean actor called Henry Irving. And he was, I think, basically fell in love with him, although he wouldn't say that. It was a great fraternal kind of love. But he was totally awestruck by the performance that Henry Irving could put on, and actually became his acting manager. So he moved almost overnight. He moved to London. He made sure he got married first, just to make it clear, I think. He moved to London. He became the manager of the famous Lyceum Theatre, which is where The Lion King is on now, and will be for many years, I'm sure. And if you go around the back of the Lyceum Theatre, there is a sign that says Irving, Stoker, Terry. So the three famous people, the two actors, Ellen Terry and Henry Irving, with Bram Stoker in the middle. So that he worked for him for 20 years, and he was a tyrant. He was a monster. He was Dracula in so many ways, Henry Irving. Henry Irving demanded that he write all of his letters. He did all the business management. He made bizarre, quixotic decisions that Bram Stoker had to act on. Bram Stoker organized at least 6 American tours on his behalf. He looked after and managed Ellen Terry and a couple of other actors. He was so good at managing people's money, in fact, that various other famous Victorians like James Whistler, the painter, said, "Would you please look after my money as well," since he was bankrupt. And somehow, being a, you know, this ridiculously overproductive Victorian gentleman, he wrote at least 4 novels in that time. He trained to become a barrister and was called to the bar. Never acted, but he was called to the bar. And 1897 was the year that he wrote Dracula. Not particular success at the time, but one that was well noted, well received, but nothing like the kind of afterlife it's had. So he actually died in great poverty. He managed to live on after Henry Irving died. As soon as Henry Irving died, he wrote this enormous 2-volume biography of his boss, great hagiography of this man, and then promptly had a stroke, and so lived in great kind of poverty for the last few years of his life. There is a great controversy about Bram Stoker's life, about whether in fact he suffered from a sexually transmitted disease, which syphilis, which couldn't be cured until the 1920s. And it's a long, painful, degenerative illness which does horrible things to you. And there is some speculation from within the family too that he might have suffered from that. But other people say there is no medical proof for this. We can't quite determine that. Maybe this is a slur on his personality. We don't have any sense of what his, quite actually, what his sexuality was, which makes him a very kind of intriguing figure, I think.
The book was published in 1897, and I was struck by two things which were going on more or less at the same time that you mentioned in the introduction to the World's Classics edition. One thing was that Oscar Wilde was in Reading jail, having been tried for indecency. And the other thing was that the year before, Sigmund Freud had come up with the term psychoanalysis. I wonder if you could just say how perhaps both of those things were in the air when Stoker was writing.
Yeah, I think the relationship between Bram Stoker and Oscar Wilde is a very complicated and very interesting one. The other biographical fact is that the woman that Bram Stoker married, Florence Balcombe, had only just turned down a proposal for marriage from Oscar Wilde back in the 1870s. So 20 years later, they're both in London. They're both from, they've known each other since childhood. Oscar Wilde is someone who is living a very different, very dangerous, very reckless life in London. And he is caught and tried by another childhood friend of Oscar Wilde and Bram Stoker, Edward Carson, who became a QC, and gets thrown in jail. Now, some people have said that there must have been a kind of real terror for Bram Stoker about what had happened to Oscar Wilde. It was his sexual misdemeanors that got him into trouble, but it was also his Irishness and his republicanism that got him into trouble. And that's the kind of politics, not nearly as openly, but that's the kind of politics that Bram Stoker had too. So maybe there was a kind of worry about that. And some critics have seen shades of the later bloated, decadent, dangerous Oscar Wilde in the figure of Dracula. I'm not quite sure that you can see it so spectacularly there. Now, the other thing you mentioned about Freud, I think, is really striking. In 1896, Freud finally coins the term psychoanalysis and gets to his own method of treatment, which we know so well, but it had been a long struggle for him trying to define precisely what his method was. And he was a very controversial figure because he put sexuality at the absolute core of our identity, and also put sexuality into children and into infants in a way that most Victorians would find horrifying, offensive, repulsive. So he wasn't particularly well known, Freud, in England until a bit later. But nevertheless, as you say, it's in the air. And I think you can put these two things together and say, well, we know how we would perhaps do a Freudian reading of Dracula, which that it is, on the one hand, full of terror about the threat to the sexual purity of women. That was a big discourse in the 1890s, a great sort of national campaign to try and clear up the country and try and protect the country from prostitution, sexually transmitted diseases, but also from the vagaries of hypocritical Victorian gentleman too. So that kind of stuff is in Dracula, definitely. And you can see it in Mina and Lucy and how Lucy is punished for her sexual views in many ways. But on the other hand, I think what Dracula is about men together and groups of men together behaving in what some people might call a homosocial way. That is, they form bonds and fraternities of men, solely of men, broadly to protect women, but nevertheless the bonds between the men are really quite striking. And I think there are lots of, it's very interesting that in the book most of the men suffer from breakdowns of various kinds or moments of hysteria. They're clearly in a way experience a kind of effeminacy. They are rendered effeminate by this kind of masterful Dracula kind of figure. So I think Stoker was a very conservative figure about gender and sexuality, but the book is totally chaotic about these kind of things in a really kind of quite overmanic, productive, hysterical way, which means that loads of readers can read lots of different things into it. You can see that this might be a book about heterosexual kind of anxieties at the end of Empire, the year of the Jubilee. But on the other hand, you can see it as all of these undercurrents of other kind of sexualities and perversities going on.
The Gothic made a bit of a comeback in the late Victorian period, and I wondered if you felt that was because it was a good genre for tackling some of these anxieties or allowing some of these anxieties to kind of sort of bubble up in narrative.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that this is quite a common line of critics, that in a way the Gothic is a very useful discourse for being able to talk about cultural anxiety in a displaced way. So the supernatural becomes and these kind of figures, liminal figures like vampires or mummies or later zombies, you know, all of these kind of things are liminal figures that in which you can negotiate between life and death, self and other, male and female, west and east, rational and the irrational mind, and so on. So it becomes a kind of very useful way of dealing with that. I think also it clearly is an investigation of anxiety, but I think if the Gothic simply did that, I wouldn't quite understand why people would want to read it so much. I mean, I think there is an immense surfeit of pleasure as well, and of, it's like disaster movies. We love watching, you know, our beloved monuments being blown to pieces, because there's a kind of pleasure, perverse pleasure in imagining those kind of disasters. So, you know, Dracula on the one hand is all of the condensations of anxiety about incomers into Victorian Britain, but he's also incredibly sexy, and people want to be that kind of figure, that transgressive figure too. So I think there are these kind of riven emotions that run all the way through it.
So how important then is it, I mean, from what you say it sounds very important, that Dracula comes to England rather than it being a story about English people in Transylvania?
Well, I think that trajectory of Dracula coming from the very, very margins of southern Europe, right on the frontier between the European Judeo-Christian empires of Europe and the Ottoman Muslim Turkish East, it's following that trajectory from that margin up into the very core of the empire. So Dracula's house in Piccadilly is as close as you can get to Buckingham Palace, so right in the centre of the empire. That trajectory is what has happened to the Gothic all the way through the 19th century. It starts out being displaced into Spain and Italy very commonly, into wild, strange, sublime kind of spaces, and increasingly all the way through the 19th and 20th century, it gets closer and closer and closer to home, until you get in the late Victorian period this immense explosion of urban London Gothic. So you have Jekyll and Hyde, you have Arthur Machen's wonderful The Great God Pan, but also you have Dracula arriving in Piccadilly. So it doesn't really focus on London for very long, and actually the book is a sort of boomerang, isn't it? It kind of starts in Transylvania, he comes to London, and then the last part of it is a chase back to Transylvania. But nevertheless, that arrival in London and the sense that this monster is at the heart of the empire is a crucial idea.
Your edition comes almost 30 years since the previous Rocks or Wilds Classics edition, which was done by A.N. Wilson. And at that stage, the text really hadn't established itself as part of the canon. It was almost like it was sort of being slipped in sideways. It almost had to be kind of apologized for, and now it's that position has completely changed. What do you think, you know, we've talked a lot about the late Victorians, what do you think has happened in our culture in the last 30 years to affect that transition?
That's a really good question, and I think there are lots of answers to that. I mean, students now at university wouldn't have a problem picking up this. I think it's only in perhaps my generation of academic teachers at university who don't have a problem with these kind of materials. So the idea of low cultural popular material having nevertheless something to say, it is the case that it's only come through in the last 30 years. That's partly to do with how literature has been taught in universities, and partly to do with the dominance of people like F.R. Leavis and his wife Q.D. Leavis, who despised popular culture and saw it as an awful degradation, usually American degradation, of refined culture, so that really we should only be reading George Eliot, D.H. Lawrence, and the good bits of Dickens. Because Dickens was also considered, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, as a popular author who shouldn't really be studied. So I think there is this kind of shift of a kind of cultural openness to it. Some people call that postmodernism, this sense of people beginning to have a much more levelled out hierarchy of taste, so that it's fine to like Keats and Bob Dylan at the same time. And it's also fine in 1897 to read miserable realist novels by George Gissing or Thomas Hardy, but at the same time also get a little bit of guilty kind of pleasure from Bram Stoker and Stevenson.
Was it the film? Because you mentioned earlier that the book had a modest success, but it wasn't a bestseller. So was it the 20th century and Dracula on the screen that really, the Nosferatu, that really made it take off?
There was some success for Bram Stoker with Dracula, and in many ways it is clearly his best book. It's his most thought through book, I think. It's most considered. The rest were quite often hack work written very fast, and you can tell, whereas this was kind of worked over for 7 years. But it is, I think, the case that in the 1920s, very far, 1910s and 1920s, very fast you begin to get these cinema adaptations. And Florence Stoker was alive long enough to begin to see these films begin to emerge and actually try and stop them, try and get her copyright from them. But nevertheless, that was the beginning of it, in a way, becoming unmoored from its origins in Bram Stoker's novel and becoming this kind of myth that extends beyond the text itself. So there is, I think, definitely something to do with that transfer from novel to film, not forgetting also, I think, the stage adaptations too. Although Bram Stoker's own stage adaptation was refused by his boss in the Lyceum, he wouldn't put it on, though there have been lots of adaptations of it on stage. And in the 1920s too, there was that huge Grand Guignol Theatre where people were looking for the most gruesome sensations and the most bloody displays of kind of violence and horror. So I think there's a moment in the 20s when it does become, it begins to speak to a new generation and actually then takes off from that point. So you have the 1920s, German expressionist films, but then you have the universal horror films in the 1930s. And then after the war, Hammer, House of Horror, take it over and do endless adaptations of it too. And then it's revived again in the 80s and revived again in the 90s. And it seems to be this just exhaust, you know, without any possibility of finishing it. It can't be exhausted. It does seem to come again and again and again and be revived again and again.
So there's a sort of perennial attraction, as you were saying earlier, about this figure, this outsider who's both terrible and at the same time attractive. And these anxieties about infiltration or penetration or something coming and contaminating, those anxieties, whatever the object, and you talk about various sort of racial interpretations and sexual interpretations, but the text is sort of inexhaustible, isn't it, in the kind of interpretations you can legitimately work through and not say, well, this is what it means, but this is the potential meaning of the text.
I think that's right. I think that's what defines a gothic monster in some ways. A successful gothic monster has to be like an open network or like a grid, which means that it's not just one thing. You can't point to it and say, I think it means it stands in for this. It has to have this element of multiplicity, of inexhaustibility about it, which means that it gets picked up and driven and altered and readapted for each new generation that reads it, so that, you know, by the time it gets to the 1980s and the 1990s, what better metaphor for the experience of sexual terror around AIDS than vampires? And you just get hundreds of films, really, that are, and novels too, that are articulating that anxiety about a renewed kind of deathly element in sexuality at that point. And then I think now we are beginning to see elements of a kind of anxiety about invasion in a much more geographical or geopolitical kind of way. So that these concerns about infiltration by small groups of terrorists who can nevertheless do massive damage and so on. That sort of sense of a racial element to the vampire has come back really strongly, whereas 10 or 15 years ago it would have been sexuality.
And with a zombie, what you see is what you get. But with Dracula, it's polyvalent, isn't it? You can see the aristocratic front, but there's something lurking underneath.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think all successful monsters have to be multivalent. So in a way, I think the vampire is, well, you can look at Stephanie Meyer's series and also the success of True Blood, Charlene Harris's collection, but also the TV series. You can see that the vampire is still running and still doing very well. But actually, I think the zombie has made a kind of a late shuffle for the front in many ways, because that is speaking to a slightly different kind of situation, which I think speaks more to us at the moment. So that sense of a mass of monsters rather than the single aristocratic lone kind of figure, we are looking at the terrible nature of mass unemployment and kind of mass rebellion and, you know, the crushing nature of labor in neoliberalism and so on. And the zombie speaks to us about all of those things in a way that perhaps the vampire doesn't quite. But the vampire, of course, hasn't gone away.